loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. The United States and North Korea have been at war since June 1950. Is it possible that this war will come to an end? Today, we are spending the full hour on the big news that Donald Trump has agreed to sit down with the leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea, with Kim Jong-un for talks. We have four prominent experts and scholars on Korea who will analyze the situation. We'll talk about North-South relations, the relations between South Korea and the United States, and of course, the relations between North Korea and the Trump White House.
But before we get to Korea, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the United Nations said today that the Syrian town of Ghouta is, quote, on the verge of a major disaster, unquote, as humanitarian aid for the 393,000 people there finally began arriving. Local Syrians in parts of East Ghouta have been protesting against the armed rebel groups that have held the area for years, calling on them to leave and to allow the Syrian army in. Rallies have been held in recently liberated areas and parts of East Ghouta, which are still under the control of hardline Islamist militants. Next, the most restrictive anti-choice law in the country was passed by the Mississippi State Legislature last night, prohibiting abortions in most cases after 15 weeks of pregnancy. A legal battle over the law appears inevitable and could call into question Roe v. Wade itself. Then we continue our weekly series where we look at the most pressing political topics of the day. We'll look at electoral politics, the political parties, and the most important issues at play in the upcoming midterm elections. And then the FARC, former guerrillas, withdrew from the Colombian presidential election after being targeted by a wave of paramilitary violence and after its candidate, Rodrigo Londono, suffered a heart attack. Meanwhile, in what could be a major shakeup in Colombian politics, progressive candidate Gustavo Petro is leading in the polls. And finally, we look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. In the latest employment report, jobs are up 313,000 last month, in the biggest jump in 1.5 years. But average hourly earnings are down from January with an increase of just 0.1%. The unemployment rate stayed steady at a low of 4.1%, although the unemployment rate as officially measured does not include underemployment, nor does it include discouraged workers, those who desire work but do not get employment. A Palestinian protester was killed in the West Bank today by Israeli forces during clashes near the city of Hebron. A wave of settlement construction in recent years has heightened tensions in the West Bank, occupied by Israel for over 50 years following the 1967 Middle East War. Clashes are expected to intensify in the run-up to the opening of the new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem in May. Kenyan political leaders Raila Odinga and Uhuru Kenyatta made a joint public appearance today to announce a process of reconciliation between the two bitter rivals. Kenyatta and his running mate, William Ruto, were declared the winners of the presidential election held last August. Odinga and his supporters alleged major voter fraud, and approximately 100 people were killed in ensuing protests. Former Trump campaign aide Sam Nunberg appeared before a Washington, D.C. grand jury today to testify in relation to the Mueller investigation. Nunberg made headlines earlier this week when he appeared on cable news claiming that he would not cooperate with Mueller. Nunberg's grand jury appearance comes the day after another former Trump campaign associate, Paul Manafort, pleaded not guilty to a new round of charges alleged by Mueller's team. Those are today's headlines. Next up is our full hour on Korea. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and clear.
Donald Trump yesterday agreed to talks with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, and their leader, Kim Jong-un. This comes quickly after DPRK announced early this week that they're willing to freeze their nuclear program for talks with the United States. We have two sets of conversations for today. First, we're joined from Philadelphia by Hyun Lee. She is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea, and she is a writer for ZoomInKorea.org. And we're joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. Welcome back, Hyun and Tim.
Thanks for inviting.
Much fun.
Hyun Lee, let's start with you. This is a monumental development. Walk us through the history of how we got to this point.
Okay, so really quickly, from 1994 to 2008, there have been a number of agreements between the United States and North Korea on denuclearization and also normalization of relations. So in 1994, we had the agreed framework. In 2000, there was the joint communique. 2005, there were the six-party talks agreements. Each time they reached an agreement, North Korea did freeze its nuclear program, but the United States somehow found a way to sabotage the agreements that were made. Until 2013, North Korea was willing to put its nuclear program on the table and agree to denuclearize in exchange for certain concessions from the United States. In 2013, the Foreign Ministry of North Korea made an announcement where they said, "We have reviewed the past two decades of negotiations with the United States. We've come to the conclusion that it's not working. The principle for action is dead." 2013, which was after 4 years of strategic patience under the Obama administration, is the year when there was a fundamental shift in North Korea's position on its nuclear weapons. That year, the Supreme People's Assembly of North Korea adopted what they called the Law on Consolidating the Position of Nuclear Weapons State for Self-Defense. And Article 2 of that law says, "North Korea's nuclear weapons serve the purpose of deterring and repelling the aggression and attack of the enemy against the DPRK and dealing deadly retaliatory blows at the strongholds of aggression until the world is denuclearized." So that is also the year that North Korea went full speed ahead in its nuclear and ballistic missile program. And that's how we got to the very tumultuous year of 2017, where we saw North Korea in its final stages of completing an effective nuclear deterrent. That's why we saw the ballistic missile test, the nuclear test. And the U.S., which was caught off guard by this, and also with the most incompetent person you could possibly have leading on this issue at the helm in the White House. So what we witnessed last year was basically a struggle between North Korea in its final drive to complete the construction of an effective nuclear deterrent versus the United States, which was determined to stop that from happening, but not really having a clue as to how to do that. And then we get to 2018, where Kim Jong-un, in his New Year speech, basically said, "We have now accomplished the cause of, quote, perfecting the national nuclear forces, and at last come to possess a powerful and reliable war deterrent, which no force and nothing can reverse." As we know, North Korea successfully tested what it called a hydrogen bomb in September of last year, and then the ICBM in November. Some people are skeptical, and they say that North Korea still has to develop a miniaturized nuclear warhead to fit on the ICBM. But the assessment of the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, as well as the Japanese Defense Ministry last year, was that North Korea had, in fact, developed a warhead that is small enough to be deliverable on an ICBM. So the fact that North Korea now has this ability to defend itself from U.S. aggression, I think changes the dynamics. And that is, I think, the result that we are seeing now.
Extremely interesting. Let's get Tim Beal in on this discussion. We're talking with also Tim Beal from New Zealand. He's an author, a professor. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. The person we're also talking with, Hyun Lee. She is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. Let's ask Tim. Tim, do you think this meeting is going to actually happen? Because there's a lot of pushback in Washington. The neocon foreign policy establishment seems to be acting like the sky is falling, that something terrible had just happened when Donald Trump said, "Yes, I'll go ahead and meet with Kim Jong-un." Sarah Sanders, his press secretary, was just asked just a few minutes ago whether it's possible that Trump won't actually go forward with the meeting. And she said, quote, There are a lot of things possible, but I can tell you that the president has accepted the invitation on the basis that we have concrete and verifiable steps. Do you think the meeting is actually going to happen?
Well, let's hope so. I can sympathize with the neocons. They must be absolutely horrified because Trump apparently sort of very impetuously agreed to this verbal communication via the South Koreans. So we don't quite know what Kim Jong-un said to them. We don't know what the South Korean said to Trump. And according to reports, everyone in the establishment in Washington was expecting that, as normal cases, it would be mulled over and, you know, they work out what they're going to do, et cetera, et cetera. And Trump jumped in and said, yes, I'll do it. I mean, I presume it is going to go ahead, but whether anything comes out of it, because this is a very, very different matter. But I can't, I mean, Trump has said that he's accepting the invitation. And obviously there's going to be a lot of pushback, as you say, from the bureaucracy. But whether they can stop him actually doing it is difficult to know. And of course, the South Koreans have now, you know, got a commitment to this too. So if the meeting doesn't go ahead, there's a lot of loss of face in Seoul as well.
I think that's right, John. I think that there's pressure now and there's also momentum. Of course, there's pushback.
You're exactly right, Brian. And there's a split even in the U.S. press where some members of the press are saying this is amazing. It's historic. It's going to lead to this new era. The other side is saying, well, not so fast. We don't know what's been agreed to. We shouldn't expect too much. But part of that problem is that the U.S. press has spent so many years vilifying the North Koreans, saying that the North Korean leadership was crazy, for example. It's a word that we like to use with authoritarian regimes that we don't get along with.
Or targeted regimes.
Or targeted regimes, indeed. I'd like to ask Han Lee, North Korea, as I said, it's painted in the mainstream media as irrational, as aggressive. But it seems like they're the ones who have shown real flexibility here, especially in the last 4 or 5 weeks. So why did the North invite Trump for talks? Why go for the brass ring right off the bat?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So going back to Kim Jong-un's New Year address, you know, he basically said, now that we have what we need to defend ourselves, we are ready to move on to other priorities. And namely, he talked about reunification and also economic development. And we have already seen the results of that. So we know that the North and South announced that they will prepare for a summit between Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in in late April. Obviously, the other bombshell coming out of the North-South meeting is that, Kim Jong-un has sent a personal letter inviting Trump to a summit. Obviously, this is a dramatic turnaround from North Korea's position last year. What has changed? If we ask ourselves that question, North Korea's goal has always been to get to the negotiating table with the United States as an equal partner, meaning talk to the U.S. as nuclear power to nuclear power. With the completion of its nuclear deterrent, it is now able to do that. According to the Joseon Ilbo, Kim Young-chul, the vice chair of the Central Committee of the Workers' Party, who was in Seoul recently for the closing ceremony of the Olympics, said to Moon Jae-in, basically, we intend to talk with the U.S. as nuclear power to nuclear power. Yesterday, there was a KCNA interview with the spokesperson for North Korea's foreign ministry, who basically also said the kind of talk we want with the U.S. is to discuss and resolve all issues of mutual concern between countries of equal position. The completion of the nuclear deterrent for North Koreans, it gives them the confidence now to get to the negotiating table with the United States as equal partners. And that's what they intend when they you know, if a summit is actually realized between Kim and Trump.
That's the voice of Hyun Lee. Tim Beal, let's turn back to you. I'm looking at a Washington Post article, and the headline goes along exactly as Hyun Lee mentioned. But in a way, the article or the headline is a little bit, it seems to me a little bit snarky and maybe even racist.
Oh, there's a surprise.
Yeah, really a big shocker. But the headline is, Kim Jong-un wants to be seen as Donald Trump's equal. A meeting would do that. As if that's something that Americans might think to be a bad thing.
Right, something that, to be avoided.
Like why should a Korean head of state be considered like an equal? But that is a big part of it. And it seems that the DPRK took advantage of the Obama administration's so-called strategic patience doctrine that Hyun Lee alluded to earlier. I think the U.S. treated North Korea with such hubris and such arrogance that the idea was, we'll just ignore North Korea. We'll try to impose sanctions. We'll try to create a famine so people are very hungry, or that they're dying because they can't get necessary medicines. We'll do all that to the people, but we just won't engage with them. And during that period of strategic patience, the North Koreans shocked the United States by really showing an advanced technological prowess, both in nuclear capabilities and in missile technology. And perhaps that actually has shifted the relationship of forces. What do you think?
Well, yes, obviously it has. I mean, going back, it's not merely the question of the nuclear weapons. North Korea's position is that it is a sovereign state talking to other sovereign states. So this is the sort of, if you like, United Nations framework, one sovereign state to another sovereign state, and states are equal in sovereignty. But, of course, in reality, the states are very hugely in power. And the interesting development, of course, is that the nuclear deterrent has provided North Korea with deterrence and nothing else could do. So this is, really, as you said, really shifted the balance of power. And I think we've got that in the background. And I think the North Koreans quite rightly see, and I think the neocons and the establishment in Washington agrees with them, that Trump is the weak chink in the American armor. So that's why the personal invitation to him, because, as Chun Li said, he's hugely incompetent. He doesn't really understand what's going on and what to do. He's narcissistic. But
you know, the other thing is, competence isn't really a job qualification for a U.S. president. Just think of who we've had: Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush. I mean, who would have thought that they would be, you know, eminent theoreticians or strategists or big grandmasters? But Donald Trump might want to see himself as, like, in the role of Richard Nixon, Hyun Lee. You know, he went to China. He, Richard Nixon, the hard right, anti-communist. We only talked that at that time, we meaning the U.S. media, about the People's Republic of China as Red China, the Chinese communist menace. And you know, Nixon went there and it changed politics. It changed the world constellation of forces. And in fact, led to a major rapprochement between the U.S. and the deep and China. China took its rightful place at the United Nations, including inside the Security Council. Maybe Donald Trump sees himself that way, but again, his own freedom of action would be, I would think, severely limited when you have a cabinet full of generals. And then, of course, there's the issue of South Korea and whether the South Korean government. Also living in the reality of tens of thousands of American troops in South Korea, whether it has the kind of sovereignty necessary to go forward against the American sort of predisposition against the DPRK, if it wanted to accelerate the thaw, the relaxation of tensions between North and South. So let's talk about Trump, if we could, if you want to, and also about what Moon Jae-in is trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the Trump administration still thinks that it can force North Korea to capitulate and give up its nuclear weapons through what it calls maximum pressure. And in fact, if you watch the Fox News, that's exactly the framing. You know, maximum pressure is working, and Trump has you know, basically brought North Korea now to the table. But I think the opportunity for that kind of negotiation has been long gone since 2013. I think when North Korea says it wants to talk to the U.S., it doesn't mean another long, drawn-out process of negotiations that go nowhere, as have previously happened in the past. It means a final resolution of fundamental issues. So ending the Korean War, normalizing relations, removing the U.S. threat to its sovereignty. I think it would be instructive for us to go back and look at North Korea's government statement back in July 2016, and it made five demands in exchange for denuclearization. One is all nuclear weapons of the U.S. and South Korea must be publicly disclosed. Two, all nuclear weapons in the South should be dismantled and verified. Three, Washington must guarantee that it will not deploy offensive nuclear weapons in South Korea and its vicinity. That would mean suspending military exercises that involve strategic weapons, as they do now. Number four, U.S. must commit to never using nuclear weapons against North Korea. Five, Washington must withdraw from South Korea all troops holding the right to use nukes. So, I mean, basically they're saying you eliminate the nuclear threat against us and we will do the same. And North Korea's, you know, fundamental demands have been pretty consistent. They haven't changed. What has changed, as I've said in the, before, is that it can now negotiate from a position of power. I'm assuming a Kim-Trump summit, possibly in May, means that there will be preparatory talks leading up to that. There may have been back-channel talks leading to this moment. And I think, I don't know if Trump realizes that when he gets to the summit, it means putting some of the U.S. strategic interests on the table. What may be at stake for the U.S. is its ability to continue to sell weapons to South Korea and Japan, maintain troops in South Korea and its hegemonic position in the region, its ability to justify its ballooning nuclear arsenal and defense budget by raising the specter of the North Korean threat, so-called. You know, the threat of peace on the Korean Peninsula undermines the interests of the military-industrial complex. And whether this has all been thought through by the Trump administration when Trump agrees to a summit with North Korea, you know, I'm completely in the dark about that.
Well, we can guess, though. We can guess, I think, that Donald Trump hasn't thought this through fully.
No, not if Rex Tillerson didn't know it was happening and H.R. McMaster didn't know it was happening.
Yeah, let's ask him about this. I mean, Rex Tillerson said just hours before Trump announced that he had agreed to come to meet with Kim Jong-un after South Korean envoys met there. And he ran out to the press room to tell the press there's going to be a big announcement. He was very, very excited. But hours before, Rex Tillerson had said talking to the North Koreans wasn't in the offing. It was going to be not in the near future. It would be a long time from now. And then today, Rex Tillerson said, well, if Trump said that, he said it on his own. In other words, disassociating himself from the president. And at the same time, a few months ago, when Tillerson was actually trying to talk to the North Koreans, Trump said, oh, Rex, you're wasting your time. I mean, he actually talked like that about his own Secretary of State in public, like cutting him off at the knees. Again, will this hold or is, I mean, Trump has the authority to go forward, Tim Beal, because he is the president. He's the commander in chief. But obviously, if he hasn't thought it through and a lot of people are telling him right now, this is dangerous. Or as Hyun Lee is suggesting, that it's not just the North Koreans who have to give in the talks. It has to be also the United States, which puts on the table some of its strategic, and I mean vital strategic regional assets. Perhaps there will be additional blowback. Anyway, your take on all that.
Yeah, well, I'm reminded of the Iranian foreign minister a wee while ago talking about negotiations. The whole point about negotiation is a compromise. You have to, you know, you take something, you have to give something. And Trump, I'm not sure if actually realizes that. I suspect what we're going to get is some, you know, we have the summit and we have some sort of agreement. The one of the questions then is whether the United States will stick to the agreement, whether it will be sabotaged by the bureaucracy, by the various forces within the establishment. And this has happened constantly in the past, not merely with North Korea, but around the world. The United States has got a very bad reputation for not sticking to agreements. So the whole thing is very much up in the air. We don't know if Trump really understands what he's got to discuss and what will actually happen at the time. And even if he does make some sort of agreement at a summit, then there's plenty of scope for opposition within the establishment to sabotage it. So it's going to be an anxious couple of months while we see if it does go ahead and then what happens. Let's hope that it is productive, but I think left and right people are very skeptical.
Hanley, I want to go back to something that you raised. I think it was in July 2016 you said the DPRK outlined its five-point program of what it would take from the United States and in concert with negotiations with the DPRK for the DPRK to abandon or give up its nuclear weapons. And you outlined those 5 points. I think that was an extremely important message that they brought and that you're bringing to this show, because I don't think the American people know about this at all. Now, the point that you said is that they have to give up, the United States has to give up nuclear weapons in the Korean Peninsula. They have to do an audit. I think most people don't know that it was the United States that introduced nuclear weapons into the Korean Peninsula starting in 1958 and only took them out, I think, in 1991. But also in 2002, under George W. Bush, the Nuclear Posture Review, I believe at this time, I mean, at that time, you can correct me if I'm wrong, stipulated that North Korea might be one of those areas in the world that the U.S. would consider a first strike nuclear attack. And it was at that time that the DPRK left the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and began building nuclear weapons. Is that right?
That's right. Article 10 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty says that any state that feels that their sovereignty is threatened by special circumstances has the right to withdraw from the treaty. And North Korea exercised that right. It legally exited the Non-Proliferation Treaty after, as you mentioned, former President Bush threatened North Korea with a first strike and then also invaded, bombed Afghanistan and invaded Iraq. And North Korea saw what was happening and said, we are giving notice now that we are going to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which they eventually did. And so, you know, people point to North Korea's nuclear weapons as a violation against, international law. But actually, North Korea has a legal right to possess nuclear weapons, especially in a threat against its sovereignty from the United States.
John Kiriak, we have a minute left, but Hyun's right. I mean, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, you were in government. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is a quid pro quo. The non-nuclear powers agree to forego nuclear weapons, and the nuclear powers begin disarming and getting rid of their nuclear weapons. You can't say U.S. has been conforming to that treaty.
No, that you're right. That's the idea, and the U.S. doesn't conform to the treaty. You remember, we used to have an agency within the State Department called ACTA, the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, the operative word being disarmament, and that agency just went away because, frankly, we don't disarm. We'll never disarm. So it didn't even mean anything in
and
its existence.
And there's no UN Security Council emergency sessions every time the U.S. sets off a new nuclear test, which is about once a week, everybody. The U.S. has 5,000 operational nuclear weapons. Anyway, we are completely out of time. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Hyun Lee. She's a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. I urge everyone to read her writings and the other writings of people who are paying attention to Korea at zoominkorea.org. And we've been joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we're going to come back, John, and continue the discussion on Trump's announcement that he will meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Stay with us.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're spending the first full hour talking about the announcement by Donald Trump that he has agreed to meet with Kim Jong-un, the head of state of North Korea, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. We are joined from Columbia, Ohio, in this segment by Gregory Ilitch. He is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea and the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit. And we're also joined from Santa Cruz, California, by Dr. Christine Hong. She is an associate professor of critical race and ethnic studies at UC Santa Cruz and a member of the Korea Policy Institute. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Christine, we talked to Gregory Ilitch yesterday, a pre-recorded segment for today about things related to Korea, but of course, it's a different world today than it was yesterday. A very different world. Just let's start with you. You've been a longtime activist. You're a journalist. You're an academic. You're Korean and paid careful attention to and been an advocate for peace and reunification in Korea for a long time. How did you feel when the announcement was made yesterday, last evening, that Donald Trump has accepted the invitation of Kim Jong-un, a message sent to him vis-a-vis South Korean envoys who came to Washington following their meetings in Pyongyang with the DPRK leadership. How did you feel? What were your reactions?
Well, I think like everyone else, I'm stunned. You know, I still don't quite know what to feel. You know, I mean, this has definitely, things have shifted so enormously. And I'd say that, you know, from the start of this year, you know, there was a sense that Donald Trump's threats of fire and fury like the world had never, you know, seen, and his threats to totally destroy North Korea, there was a strong sense from the beginning of the year that that was 2017, and that somehow the winds of change were blowing this year. And so from the very outset, North Korea not only, you know, in Kim Jong-un's, you know, historic New Year's address, and, you know, everyone always reads or listens to these addresses for their indication for which way the wind is blowing. And what he stated was both that he would be open to sending a North Korean delegation to the Olympics and indeed transforming those Olympics into a peace Olympics. But he also stated that he was invested in a peaceful peninsula, and that the peninsula should be a peaceful environment. And, you know, at that time, Vladimir Putin basically stated that, you know, this young leader who had made enormous nuclear strides, I mean, basically he changed the strategic calculus. And Vladimir Putin praised Kim Jong-un as, I think it was something like a smart and mature leader who had in many ways bested Trump. So it's, you know, I think right now what we're seeing against the way that this is being presented in the you know, corporate media in the West, which is that Trump had a coup and that his, you know, his policy of maximum pressure worked. You know, there's also another sort of group of people who are stating that this is all to the credit of Moon Jae-in. But few people are actually looking in deep, you know, deep detail at the fact that North Korea essentially changed the strategic calculus. And it's North Korea that has invited first South Korea and now the United States to the peace table.
Excellent points. Gregory Ilitch, you know, when you read some of the media reports about this announcement, it's almost like the sky is going to fall because Trump had said he's willing to talk to Kim Jong-un. And the language of coup or the language of the gamble, as if talking to the DPRK was, you know, taking a trip to Mars and, you know, and meeting, you know, outer terrestrial aliens and it was very, very dangerous to talk to the DPRK. But in many ways, the DPRK has been remarkably consistent. They've said they only need nuclear weapons because of the enduring hostile policy, threatening policy of the U.S. And of course, the war exercises that will happen again, at least over the years, have simulated the decapitation of the leadership of the DPRK, the destruction of the country, the invasion of the country, carrying out regime change. I mean, very threatening and very huge military exercises. But North Korea has always said very plainly and consistently, we are doing what we are doing, in this case, developing nuclear weapons, because we have to meet the challenge faced by us, posed by the United States. And what we really want is a change in a hostile policy. Now, Gregory, just to preface one more quick point, when we talked to you earlier this week and you said, well, I don't know what a security guarantee would look like from the United States to the DPRK, to the DPRK's satisfaction. Maybe the DPRK isn't really seeking ultimately a security and a full guarantee of security, because, of course, the U.S. will always want to carry out regime change. But maybe what the DPRK wants is just what it appears, normalization of relations.
It's hard to separate those two things, because I think they are in tandem. And North Korea, regardless of recent events, certainly still retains in its mind the experience that Libya had after it had dismantled its nuclear program, only to be bombed a few years later. So I think it's still important to the DPRK that the security of its system is guaranteed, and then, as it says, military threats are resolved. And I really don't know how that would be. Any written agreement or verbal agreement from the United States, frankly, can't be trusted. A peace treaty has symbolic value, but I don't see that it would deter the United States from attacking if we're so inclined. It may be, I think, that Kim Jong-un has some specific idea in mind how a security could be ensured, perhaps maybe some kind of commitment by China to come to its aid if it's attacked, or I don't know what. That remains to be seen. But of course, more than anything, it wants normalization of relations. There's an extreme power imbalance between the United States and North Korea. North Korea's GDP is less than Vermont, and Vermont ranks last among U.S. states. And U.S. military spending, if you take into account also that the nuclear weapons program is funded through the Department of Energy, and that there's also separate funding for military operations, comes close to matching the entire rest of the world combined, their military spending. So I think North Korea sees that security is essential in order to ensure that the normalization of relations.
Yeah. And of course, normalizing relations does not mean that the U.S. won't continue to try to overthrow your government.
Absolutely. We had normalized relations with Syria until relatively recently.
And normalized relations with Libya. Mm-hmm. Of course, earlier there were normal relations between the U.S. and Iraq. I mean, it's clear too, Christine, when Obama opened up an embassy in Havana, and likewise Cuba opened up an embassy here in Washington, D.C. That was the beginning of a process of normalization. That doesn't mean that the U.S. has given up its desire to overthrow the Cuban government, for instance. It still wants to do that if the opportunity arises. But nonetheless, Cuba thinks, well, this is better. It would be better to have normal relations than a relationship that's fraught with constant, ever-present tension and threats, because these are smaller countries that have to divert big parts of their resources as Gregory is pointing out, they're very limited resources to national defense, as opposed to providing, say, consumer goods or other infrastructure development. Anyway, Christine, go ahead and talk about what North Korea wants.
I mean, I think that I also want to speak to some of the points that you just raised. I think it's important for people to understand that this current North Korean leader, his policy is a Pyongjin policy, and it's basically a policy that's twofold in nature. It's not simply a military first policy. This, of course, was the Songun policy of Kim Jong-il, the current leader's father. And that was aimed at a defensive posture against the United States, which is, the world's greatest, sort of military power in the world. And, you know, by contrast, this current Beijing policy, it emphasizes not only militarized self-defense in the form of the nuclear program, but also economics and economic development. And this is geared explicitly toward the well-being of the North Korean people. And so, you know, I think, you know, it's interesting to note that this particular policy, concedes that there is a kind of implicit concession that by diverting all of these resources toward militarized self-defense, that, you know, what the Chinese have called the people's livelihood in, you know, in UN Security Council negotiations over sanctions, that the people's livelihood of North Koreans is actually harmed. And in fact, you know, even the KCNA, North Korea's media, international media organ, has in the past decade stated that the constant need for self-defense, they've actually stated it harms the human rights of North Koreans. But it's not blaming the North Korean government. It's looking at a structural situation in which the United States has placed North Korea in an unrelenting way in the crosshairs of its war machine for several decades. You know, the U.S. posture has been one of regime change. And so I think right now the question that we need to think about in deep ways is, what does peace truly look like? You know, beyond the symbolic power of a peace treaty, what does it mean to have normalized relations? And what sort of possibilities are there moving forward? Is it possible for us to envision peace between the United States and North Korea when the United States has never in any way accounted for its counter-revolutionary violence during the hot period of the Korean War to the current day? And this is something, Brian, that you know really well, having participated and been a key figure in the U.S. War Crimes Tribunal, you know, for Korea. And so I think the other thing that I just would say right now is it's premature for people to celebrate the maverick Trump. You know, it's premature to try to dust off the Trump that was against U.S. intervention around the world from the campaign trail. You know, if we look at what Trump has done, he's been as much of a war merchant as Obama. And, you know, his America First policy, unlike the Beijing policy of Kim Jong-un, actually does not in any way take into account the well-being of the American people. You know, he has authorized the refurbishment and the renovation of the U.S. nuclear system, and he's authorized trillions, I mean, you know, just billions upon billions of dollars to the U.S. military, and Congress even outdid him in terms of what it allocated. And so this is a president who, in terms of his structural role and his structural commitments, is very much a militarist. And so, you know, we should not be seduced by the spectacle of Donald Trump coming out seeming like a maverick. And we should really analyze this in terms of structural conditions.
We're joined from Columbus, Ohio, by Gregory Ilitch. He's a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea, and he's the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit. And we're joined from Santa Cruz, California, by Dr. Christine Hong, Associate Professor of Critical Race and Ethnic Studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and a member of the Korea Policy Institute. Greg Ilitch, Christine Hong makes a very important point there, where we have the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, just a couple of hours before this dramatic announcement, just after 7 o'clock last night, as saying that direct talks between the United States and the DPRK just were not in the offing, that they were actually pretty far in the future if they were going to happen at all. 2 hours later, Donald Trump walks to a podium and confirms a South Korean report that there is going to be a direct face-to-face meeting between Donald Trump and the North Korean leadership. So who actually is minding the store here? That we know that this announcement was not coordinated with the State Department. Rex Tillerson made that obvious. We know this morning that it was not coordinated with the National Security Council. This is not how you carry out a foreign policy. So is the policy direct talks with the North Koreans, or is the policy far more conservative than that, but Donald Trump has preempted it.
It's sort of something in between. Actually, Tillerson's statement is in line with what Trump had been saying before this week. But of course, Trump's given to wild mood swings, so you never know from one day to the next what he's going to come out with. But today, U.S. officials are saying that when Trump does talk to Kim Jong-un, he's going to take a hard-line position, and these are just going to be talks about talks, not a formal negotiation. So I believe that Trump is viewing this as an opportunity basically to deliver an ultimatum, a one-sided ultimatum. You have to disarm or else. And I noticed one thing in all the news media reports, anything coming out of the Moon Jae-in administration or anything coming out of Washington, nobody's said anything about what would North Korea get in return for disarmament. That seems to be a huge missing piece of the puzzle. And I think normalization relations is kind of a vague statement. I think North Korea needs something more concrete than that. Nobody's talking about that. And it's just not going to work if this is just going to be a delivery of an ultimatum.
Well, Christine, I want to get your opinion on that, if you would. Clearly, the DPRK is vesting considerable effort to the process. So they obviously feel they're going to get potentially something. In other words, they're making pretty big concessions. They're not even challenging the upcoming military exercises between the U.S. and South Korea, which had been thought, I think, by conventional wisdom earlier, that if those exercises went forward, the sort of momentum from the Olympics might be sidetracked. But Kim Jong-un says, whatever, you know, go ahead, you can have those exercises. In other words, taking away all the different hurdles and obstacles that might be put into place or provocations that people might think the North Koreans would then respond to, thus derailing the momentum for a reduction of tension. Do you share Gregory Ilitch's sort of deep skepticism about the process, about what the U.S. can or would offer DPRK and what DPRK really is trying to achieve?
You know, I do share Gregory's skepticism. It makes absolutely no sense for North Korea to make all the concessions, and it certainly is not in the strategic interest of North Korea to do so. So I highly doubt that that is the avenue that North Korea is pursuing, although up to now, based upon these successive press briefings by the South Korean delegation that has met, you know, with both Kim Jong-un and now Trump, it appears that North Korea is the one that is making all of the possible concessions. Donald Trump just this past week basically indicated that there are even more sanctions that are forthcoming. And of course, these war games will go on, although there has been some mitigation of their scope. So aircraft carriers are not going to be taking part, although they traditionally have. I guess the one thing that I would note is that according to the South Korean delegation, the language that North Korea specifically used was something that North Korea has used in the past. And it wasn't that North Korea was offering, as the media has reported, simply to denuclearize itself and that's a done deal. The language that was specifically used was that that Kim Jong-un was committed to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which actually implies and has in the past a reciprocal obligation on the part of the United States.
Yeah, let's turn to another subject if we could. We can come back to this too. But Gregory, because this isn't, it can't be, you can't isolate Korea from the region. And of course, all of this is taking place in the context of the U.S. pivot to Asia announced by Obama in 2011. And from my point of view, at least what I considered, and of course, that doesn't mean I'm right, but what I thought Obama was doing, and I thought this was an emerging consensus within the Washington foreign policy establishment, was trying to diminish the U.S. footprint in the Middle East. He was trying to withdraw troops from Iraq. He became sort of an unwilling, you know, not that enthusiastic about the war on Libya. He negotiated the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran. In other words, seeking to sort of redeploy American military, diplomatic, economic powers towards the Asia Pacific, because that's where things were. And of course, the challenge being China's rise, its peaceful rise, but its rise nonetheless to challenge U.S. hegemony regionally, but globally, in fact. And thus, that pivot goes on, even if it's been a little bit sort of confused by the Trump administration having what appears to be either a Middle East or an eclectic focus. How do you think China's going to react to this? I mean, this would be a very big discussion for China. Is China enthusiastic about it? Are they worried about it? Talk about it from their point of view, if you would.
Well, of course, the Chinese media is saying that they are welcoming any prospect of warming relations between the U.S. and North Korea. They're concerned about the possibility of a war and the impact it would have on the entire region. Although, as you allude, the United States is likely to continue its rebalance to Asia regardless of what happens. Even if it loses North Korea as a pretext along the way, it's still going to continue that buildup. I think China, like Russia, is looking towards the economic integration of North Korea and South Korea with their two countries as a wider approach to enhancing the economic development of the entire region. So Russia signed a deal with North Korea to modernize its rail system in exchange for access to mineral resources. And they also developed plans for a railway between Rajin in North Korea and Kaesong in Russia. And there were also talks about a railroad connecting South Korea, running through North Korea into Russia. And I think they were looking for expanding economic opportunities and development there, none of which can happen unless the relations warm between U.S. and North Korea and sanctions are reduced. That's not going to happen anytime soon, probably. So I think China is very much welcoming the prospect of an improvement in relations between the U.S. and North Korea. Even though the military buildup is going to continue no matter what happens.
Christine, again, about the regional impact here of these developments, clearly China sees the United States moving into a position of seeing China as a strategic competitor rather than a strategic partner, and all of that means what that means. And of course, the recent nuclear posture review, the national security strategy that was released, posits the U.S. to be in the position of planning for a major power confrontation, as ridiculous and insane as that seems, with China or with Russia. At the same time, China doesn't really have tremendous influence over the DPRK. Clearly, there's no Chinese troops in North Korea. North Korea clearly has a very developed sense of sovereignty and is exercise that sovereignty for a long time. It's not anybody's junior partner or little brother. And so China is looking at Korea in one way, really about its own interests, it seems to me. From a North Korean point of view, do you think that nuclear weapons are in fact a requirement for its national security? That's one question. And secondly, it seems to me that the Obama administration's orientation of policy of strategic patience was a big blunder, because North Korea surprised the West, and maybe it surprised China too, with the development of its nuclear and missile technology prowess far beyond what people anticipated. And thus the relationship of forces changed, not just between North Korea and the United States, but North Korea and its neighbors, including China. Go ahead.
Right. You know, I mean, I think that you're right that Obama's policy of this rebalancing or this pivot to Asia and the Pacific, and, you know, what Gregory mentioned, which was that, you know, North Korea was used as a very convenient pretext and, you know, for the United States expanding in the post-Cold War period and reconsolidating its militarized posture within the region to secure what Hillary Clinton, who was, you know, Obama's first Secretary of State, stated was America's economic future. And, you know, what happened throughout the course of Barack Obama's two terms, unlike other, you know, post-Cold War U.S. presidents, Obama didn't get vision with regard to North Korea or make any kind of strides toward engagement in his late second term. Essentially, his policy was one of no talks and big sticks. And, you know, in the process, what North Korea saw fit to do in the absence of any kind of engagement was to follow a nuclear road. And of course, this dates back to George W. Bush's 2002 nuclear posture review, in which North Korea was listed as a site of a permissible nuclear first strike by the United States. You know, the other thing too that we have to think about regionally is Japan. And I think that it was interesting to observe that even though Mike Pence at the Olympics was stating that there was, he was attempting to state that there was no daylight between the United States and its junior partners or dogs on a leash, you know, within the region. And this is using Daniel Russell's term of, he was an undersecretary of state under Obama. The fact of the matter is that it was the United States that was so transparently the wedge between the two Koreas, even though Pence was trying to assert that the historic natural relationship is between South Korea and the United States. The two Koreas marched under a unity flag. And also what happened during those Olympics is that Abe apparently spoke to Moon Jae-in, who was deputized by the South Korean people to actually push for peace with North Korea, to push for engagement with North Korea. And Abe approached Moon and stated that as soon as the Olympics and Paralympics ended, that he needed to quickly, you know, resume the U.S. Joint military exercises with the United States. And essentially what Moon told him was, mind your own business. And right now we also have Abe and his most recent comments upon these talks, and perhaps he'll prove to be correct. What he stated was that the talks between the two heads of state, you know, Trump and Kim Jong-un, he said, are meaningless. And he said that talking for the sake of talking was meaningless.
All right. I think we're going to have to leave it there. Big subject, really, really perhaps the biggest subject and the most important subject in world politics right now. We've been joined from Columbus, Ohio by Gregory Ilitch. He is a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. He's the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit. And we've also been joined from Santa Cruz, California by Dr. Christine Hong. Christine is an associate professor of critical race and ethnic studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and she is a member of the Korea Policy Institute. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be back with the big stories of the day. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.